You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vandewiel.
And I'm Joe Crawford. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, September 22nd, 2016.
Often it's difficult to document student life, faculty life, and staff. We have very little information on staff.
We hear from an archivist working on an oral history project as part of Indiana's bicentennial celebration. That's later in the show in today's episode of Big Talk with Michael Glab.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks how Bloomington defines the term middle class. But first, these local headlines.
This afternoon, a Brown County judge sentenced a Bloomington man to 80 years in prison for the murder of an IU student. 51-year-old Daniel Messel was convicted last month of murdering 22-year-old Hannah Wilson in April of last year. The sentence includes 60 years for the murder charge, plus another 20 years because Messel is what the court calls a habitual offender. Messel has prior convictions, including for battery. According to the Herald Times, Messel continued his claims of innocence today. He reportedly told the court, quote, "I didn't kill Hannah. If it was my daughter, I'd want to know what really happened," unquote. Wilson went missing in April of last year after a night of partying during the Little 500 weekend. Her body was found the next day in a field in Brown County. Police say they found Messel's cell phone near Wilson's body, and they later found her blood and hair in his vehicle. The 80-year sentence was issued by Brown Circuit Judge Judith Stewart.
Some former employees of Bloomington's General Electric Appliances plant will be eligible for a federal program that benefits workers whose jobs were lost due to international trade. The Department of Labor made that announcement yesterday. The workers will receive services through what is known as the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. The program was launched in 1962 as the Kennedy administration was expanding international trade. GE workers who were employed at the Bloomington plant after January 24th of this year will be eligible for a variety of services. Dennis Weimer, who oversees the program's operations in Indiana, says those affected should visit the local Work One office, as the program's requirements can be complicated to navigate.
It's a very detailed program. There's a lot of different components to it. And the first step to that is to connect with the Work One staff who can help walk everyone through what are the details and what kind of benefits an individual might be eligible for. You know, if someone needs training to enhance their skills or take them up to a new level or give them, if they're going to move into another career field, it will pay for training to do that. There are certain caveats to that training, again, too long to go into. It also has some subsistence after their unemployment insurance ends. It will help have some subsistence payments while they're going through training.
Workers may also be eligible for job search and relocation allowances, as well as health insurance premium assistance. The Bloomington GE plant produced its last refrigerator at the end of August. GE's appliance division was purchased by the Chinese company Haier earlier this year.
During its second budget hearing of the week, the Monroe County Council unanimously approved a 6% salary increase for the county auditor. County Council member Marty Hawk proposed the increase, saying the position includes duties beyond what the auditor is currently being paid for.
Well, our auditor is required to be at county commissioners' meetings to keep track of and keep track of the votes, required to be a part of all the county council meetings, keeping track of the votes, required to be a part of these major budget hearings.
The auditor's new salary will be $60,512. That's an increase of $3,200. Hawk based her request on the fact that the county clerk receives an additional $3,200 for serving on the election board, and the county assessor receives an additional $2,500 for training and certification. Hawk said she'd not discussed her proposal with the current auditor, Therese Chambers. Hawk said the council decided several years ago to make the salaries for auditor, treasurer, clerk, and recorder the same, and looking back, she regretted that. Councilmember Lee Jones agreed.
There really is a bit of an inequity going on with this, that some offices require an awful lot more from their elected official than others do.
Council members Eric Spoonmore and Jeff McKim asked about the impact the raise would have on this chief deputy's salary, which is set at 75% of the auditor's salary.
I've been agreeing with that for a long time, too. This idea that all five are paid exactly the same doesn't really make much sense anymore. And I understand the kind of political compromises in the past that led that to come about. My challenge is more with the chief deputies, because I'm really hoping to move the chief deputies out of the 75% of the elected officials range. Yeah. So doubling down on that formula, it doesn't sit well with me.
The salary for the position of chief deputy will now be $45,384.
In their meeting this week, the Bloomington Board of Public Works approved the city's first parking day to be held on Friday, October 14th. Sean Starowitz, the city's assistant director of economic development for the arts, says Parking Day is an international event.
Parking Day is an annual worldwide event where artists, designers, and citizens transform metered parking spots into temporary public parks. The purpose is to transform metered parking spaces into temporary public spaces. This is an international project begun in 2005.
The Bloomington event is a collaboration between the city and the organization Open Streets Bloomington. The city's planning and transportation, park and recreation, and the housing and neighborhood development departments will make presentations during the event. Open Streets organizer Mac Flaherty said the event combines creativity with civic engagement.
We're going to make those three spaces into a small park. There's going to be a reading corner, some cafe tables, different activities like a giant Jenga game. And we have also spoken with businesses and reached out to them along the route on the north side of 6th Street there. We spoke with whomever was available at each business. In some cases that was managers, in some cases not, but we left a flyer with details as well, asking them to reach out to us if they had any questions or concerns. No one has reached out to us and asked anything or spoken negatively, and several of the businesses were vocally positive. The rug shop there suggested that they would be able to donate rugs potentially for us to use in the space. And absent that, we would lay turf in the space or something like that to make it more park-like as well. And King Dough was also on board, and we brainstormed that perhaps people could eat their pizzas and salads at our tables out in a park in front of their place.
The group will also be leading historic tours throughout the day. Public Works Director Adam Wason said Mayor John Hamilton will hold open office hours at some point during the event. Board Vice President Kelly Boatman questioned whether the purpose of the event would be clear to the public. Open Streets organizer Matt Flaherty responded.
Again, under the umbrella of tactical urbanism, the idea of these types of things, they're low cost, easy to install, they're temporary, and just work at beautifying neighborhoods or public spaces, and again, engaging the public. And in this case, engaging the public with the government, which I think is great.
Board President Kyla Cox-Deckard expressed concern that the event is being held on homecoming weekend. Flaherty said he thought homecoming would only increase the event's level of public engagement. The event will run from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on October 14th. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Joe Crawford. Indiana University is preparing to celebrate its bicentennial in 2020, just as the state of Indiana celebrates its own 200th birthday this year. Part of the university's commemoration is its oral history project, begun in 2008. IU bicentennial archivist Kristen Lehman Morris joins Michael Glab on today's Big Talk to discuss her role in collecting recordings of faculty, alumni, and support staff members talking about life on campus, including both everyday descriptions and extraordinary stories and personalities. the papers, the photos, the videos, and now the voices of the university will be available to the public on the soon-to-be-opened IU Bicentennial website.
This is Big Talk. Big Mike, Michael Glab here. My guest today, Kristen Lehman Morris. She's the archivist for the Indiana University Bicentennial. Now, for those of you who aren't up on Latin, bicentennial implies 200-year anniversary. Right now, this year, it is the state's bicentennial.
Yes.
Indiana University's bicentennial is?
2020.
So that's 4 years off, and work already is going into this project. So, archivist, what do you do all day?
My job is mostly having to do with the archives. And basically, I am the liaison for IU Archives and the IU Bicentennial. So I am support for departments or individuals who are wanting to celebrate the bicentennial and need historical information on their department. I am the go-to person for that.
Why would anybody need historical information on their department?
Well, for the bicentennial, there are a lot of signature projects that are happening right now, and we're building up for celebrations. So departments are already planning things like timelines, historical timelines of their department to add on their website. And there are also a lot of signature projects that have been planned through the Office of the Bicentennial as well. One of the signature projects that I work closely with is the Bicentennial Oral History Project. We're focusing on collecting oral histories and stories of alumni and then retired and current faculty and staff and learn about their experiences and their years at IU. Because in the IU archives, we have faculty papers, we have departmental records, we have presidential papers, but often it's difficult to document student life, faculty life, and staff. We have very little information on staff, which includes service staff, support staff, and professional staff. So this allows us to really collect wonderful data on the individuals who have experienced IU over many years, some of whom are 50-year employees.
You could get some good stuff from a janitor telling stories.
Absolutely.
And have you done that already?
We are getting to that point. Uh-huh. So the project itself started in 2008, and we have collected 400 alumni oral histories. But now we are branching out to faculty and staff. Another thing that we need to do is create a way to share all of this information with the public. Mm. So we're looking at something called the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer, OHMS for short, because librarians like acronyms.
Yeah.
It's a way that you can put all of the oral history audio files online for people to search them. So they could search by campus, they could search by individuals who mentioned the Little 500, mm-hmm. individuals who want to talk about NICs or places on campus that were cool hangouts. So it allows us to share that information quickly and have all of those audio files up for everybody to listen to.
Have you heard any of these recordings?
I have. One that stands out to mind is Gloria Randall Scott's oral history. And she was here in the 1950s, and she was the first African-American student in the zoology department and a woman. And so she discusses the wonderful things that Indiana University had done for her, but she also discusses some of the challenges that she had even in a classroom setting where she was receiving C's on homework, and when she would compare it to other students who had A's, her answers would be the same, but the grade would be different. So good and bad. And also, the way it was handled with Gloria Randall Scott's case, she went to Herman B. Wells, and he dealt with it. So there is that very positive side of understanding that certain people played significant roles in the history of the university to create stronger and better paths for those who would come after them.
Gloria, you're saying, had the guts to go to the president of the university and say, here are some of the obstacles that I'm facing.
Yes.
How about that?
And that was, you know, and Herman B. Wells listened to her and worked it out.
She must have been something else.
Yeah. She's a very strong lady from what I could gather from her oral history, and very successful. What I will do sometimes is write a blog post on the Indiana University Archives blog and create snippets of oral history so that people can read the blog post and then actually listen to snippets of oral histories as well.
Now do me a favor and tell me precisely how a listener might access that blog.
So you can go to the IU Libraries website and search by repositories and libraries and go down to University Archives. Mm-hmm. Click on that, and then our webpage will come up, mm-hmm. and you will see on the left-hand side resources, and down there is Blogging Hoosier History, and that is us. On the Bicentennial website, which is 200.iu.edu, you can go to the Bicentennial Oral History Project webpage, and we're still building it, but there's a volunteer form on that page, and you can volunteer your story. You can suggest people who you think we need to interview.
What you're doing seems like such a blast. Why do you get to do it and I don't? What is so special about you?
You're right. How I fell into this, I was working on my master's degree in English literature at Purdue University, actually.
I've heard of it.
Yes, that other school up north. And I was working on medieval and early modern studies, so I would have to use a lot of online resources, and I found myself becoming frustrated using only online sources. I wanted to use primary sources. Mm-hmm. So when I started my PhD program at Purdue, within the first year I decided I needed a master's in library science. And it happened that my best friend was working on her library science degree at IU at the time. So she invited me down and I went to the Lilly Library and met with Joel Silver, talked to him about the rare books and manuscripts specialization within library science, and was immediately hooked. So I commuted from Purdue to IU every week and worked on my PhD and my master's in library science at the same time.
Wow.
And it was busy, but it was worth every mile. I was fortunate to get a position at the Lilly Library as their special collections cataloger. And I was there for a few years, and the position at the archives opened up. So I applied for that, and I received that job in January of 2016 and started February. And so I have been
just
there.
Just this year.
Just this year.
Kristen Lehman Morris, one of the archivists for the IU Bicentennial. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
That was WFHB correspondent Michael Glab speaking with IU Bicentennial archivist Kristen Lehman Morris. You can find that and all episodes of Big Talk at our website, wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small business. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street. Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. This week on Voices in the Street, cash, money, influence. What defines the middle class? The middle class is the bedrock of America, the foundation upon which this nation has grown and thrived over the last 240 years. It's no small surprise that the middle class is defined differently than it was 200 years ago, and there are constant theories of the middle class being eroded away in today's society.
Voices in the street hit the streets to ask your friends and neighbors what they think the middle class is and what are some of its defining characteristics.
Well, middle class life definition to me would be a person that has money and resources that they're able to use, and a poor person like me that doesn't have hardly anything. That's my definition of a middle class.
Relative financial comfort, and they probably don't work with their hands, although it's increasingly difficult to tell these days to make those kinds of distinctions.
I guess people who don't work paycheck to paycheck, you know, can actually afford when their car breaks down and just pay to have it fixed, however many thousands of dollars that could be. Probably people who own their own homes too, and that's about where it is. The lower class has kind of got the stiff end of it right now. I want to say there's more lower class than there is middle. People live in like income-based housing, who are on Section 8 or have HUD, is it? HUD, have stuff like that, who have to help and get assistance because they need assistance rather than not.
I mean, how I see it, it's basically just an income thing, not necessarily like a cultural or a racial thing. So, I don't know, people who make between like $50,000 and $100,000 a year or something.
From a purely economical standpoint, I imagine it has to do with income, which would be, to say middle class, probably between, pretty large margin, I would say between 30 and 70K a year, 30 and 80K a year. Demographically, that's probably mostly white people. People brought up in the middle class, not from a different class than brought into it, but people raised in the middle class, in my small exposure to them, seem to be a little less understanding of other financial situations or other classes that aren't the middle class. But I think that's pretty common amongst anyone who hasn't changed a social class in their life.
The defining qualities of the middle class here in America?
Yeah.
Hardworking, work ethic, generally underpaid. I think those would be my biggest ones, yeah. Gosh, that's tough to say. I'm not particularly well informed, I don't think, about what defines the middle class, but I would say working adults somewhere in the age of 22 to 40, well, really anywhere in the 50s, I guess, up until retirement, but your average income would probably be no more than $60,000, $70,000 a year, somewhere in that neck of the woods.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Kelly Worley. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music provided by The Impossible Shapes. For WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.